Chris, let's take us into the next show then. And is Merlin James also, were you also a virgin Merlin Jamesian, or is he someone you've been following? Yes.
No, I worked as an art handler at Sikkema Jenkins and Company for 3 or 4 years. So most of the artists there, James included, I've handled their work and spent a substantial amount of time watching, looking at what they do. And over the holidays, I listened to some lectures by Merlin James without knowing you hadn't contacted me yet about this. I think he's a really interesting painter. One of the things that I noticed, let me start off by saying I like him as a painter. He's one of the people I really just enjoy as a thinker in the history of painting, in the contemporary assessment of like what constitutes an intellect in painting. The only issue that I had with it, and I'll say that because this, I'll share this issue because most of what I have to say is not negatively critical, is that over the years, and I think it's something that just happens to artists in general, once they have a certain amount of support, that the paintings just kind of have stayed the same. There's been a refinement of his original project, but at the same time, and it's a very, you know, it's very, I think it's a smart and valuable and still generative, but in terms of looking at it, I got it. And I think I was more impressed with the paintings that, or more interested in the paintings that were turned backside forward, or that he had stretched. One of the ones, Sunset, he stretched nylon, a hosiery over it.
Yeah.
I thought it was, in terms of dealing with color, it was fantastic. And I always love it when painters use materials that aren't paint in order to index color and texture. So I think there's something there. I also really love the fact that there were so many paintings there. The room was filled. In spite of the kind of cavernous space that Sikkema Jenkins is, the paintings felt cozy and nice. So I really enjoyed it. I mean, I can tell you more about what I like.
Yeah, we'll come back to you. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Vincent, Chris mentions the sensation of Merlin James's striking consistency, which I think is reinforced for us by the fact that almost every show he does has some kind of retrospective aspect to it. He sort of picks from the palette of his whole oeuvre with each new manifestation. But what has always struck me, and I've followed his work since the early 1990s, is that even when he is drawing from older work, and even though almost all his painterly concerns were there with him as a graduate student already, he somehow, with each show, moves into a new chapter with new emphases and with certain departures. And it struck me that this was actually formally, for him, like a rather bold exhibition of new ventures, although they're not totally new. I mean, there's the, Chris has described some of them, there's the inversion, looking at the backside, seemingly, of the canvas. There's the departure in actually having eschewed frames for most of his career, of making a kind of almost Hodgkin-esque fetish sometimes out of the frame. And then there's this weird, I don't know how to describe it, this bowing in of the sides. So, and then there's nylon, and then there's some sex. So there's lots of new things while still being Merlin James. Did this seem to be a transitional or a innovative show to you, or did you feel that you were on very secure territory with Merlin James?
He's like in the groove. He's a different kind of artist. He's just, I think I could compare him to Mirandi. It's like, he's a great artist. He does what he does. They're changes. but they're not radical departures. But for me, I'm not, you know, I don't look for radical departures in every artist. I mean, I see what they do. And for him, it's, you know, you brought up the question of scale before with Mama Anderson, and that's obviously a big question with Merlin James, because you go into the show and, you know, whereas in her exhibition, okay, it was in that gallery, the works actually looked kind of dwarfed to me. In Merlin James's show, you go in and you think, oh, this is a bunch of small paintings. But after you're there, you adapt to the scale. And the scale is very appropriate. It feels very specific and carefully chosen. And basically, each work is different in size and scale. They're slight, they're kind of manicured and totally, you know, explicitly chosen, the details. And what you were mentioning about the bowing, I think, is also... I guess he's done it before, I read, in the 80s, but this is a new kind of tweak, I guess. Like, he does a lot of tweaking to the things that he's that, you know, are familiar in his work. But I just wanted to say, in the aspect of seeing the works, like, supposedly or apparently the backs of works, which he's done before, I felt that they were much more successful in this exhibition. And I think it was because of the use of that nylon or fabric, whatever it was, it made it, it gave it much more of a depth. And so it became more of an image rather than what could have been perceived as a gimmick, like, oh, well, this is, or, you know, or just an idea, the back of a painting. But I find that I, you know, once I adapt to the work, it's some of the most interesting painting, of contemporary painting, that I can find to look at.
Right. Is that a verdict you'd share, Martha?
Yeah, I'm crazy about his painting. I just love it. I pitched it for this review panel. David sends us a bunch of stuff, and I was like, Merlin James.
You and three other people, but yes.
I just love it. And I'm a little stuck on, like, whether people should change or not. I don't know. Who knows? I just want to go in and see a show and be kind of knocked out. And with this one, I haven't seen a show of his and thought, like, oh, yeah, no. There's always something. And when we were talking about history with the with Mama Anderson, and somehow, you know, I mean, I've studied a lot of art history, so I'm a little bit sensitive about it. But the thing is that all painting is art historical. I mean, there's just no way around it. And he does such a great job. I mean, just sort of, you'd go through and you'd have these little surprises. There's one that reminds me so much of James Ensor, but you would never, you know, actually say, oh, well, he was whatever. But if you've kind of, yeah, it's this one called Willow. There are other ones that have these kind of Whistler touches. Some remind me of Redon, you know, so this weird symbolist quality. Others, like one of the ones I think you showed it, it's called Marine Painting, and it's got this central thing. It's actually a palette and some brushes, but it reminds me of like a Bonnard still life. It's just, that's the way that you know, you have that sensation of standing in front of the painting and being like, they had that same feeling when they were at, you know, whatever, looking at Ensor, that you're getting it sort of, you know, repeated back to you. And that's the real joy of this kind of painting. A couple of other things I love, you know, the holes in the canvas thing, that's kind of a signature of his. But it's just great, some of them, where you look and it's like it's been worn away, and then you think it's the wall, but then, you know, he's got like another piece of burlap. The other thing, there are these little spots, you know, maybe you can see it on my phone, where it looks like a...
you can see in the back row, can you?
Yeah. Where it's kind of like...
Actually, let's do what critics are supposed to, which is describe.
We're talking about a painting.
That's okay, you're tired, so I'll do it for you.
No,
it's a landscape painting that would evoke William Nicholson, but at the bottom there's a strip.
Yeah, but the strip is, and here's what the strip is, that you don't do that in painting. That's a photography thing.
Exactly.
So he's put the color strip from photography, except it's not, you know, RGB or any of that. So it's just cool, you know? You're like, in the same way, see? They want to see it. So in the
this
same
is a recording
way,
nightmare. I mean, of course...
Well, they can go online because it exists.
We will make sure the image is on the page with the podcast.
Well, we've described it. We've done the job. It's strokes.
If you imagine a William Nicholson landscape of hills that are heading towards the ocean, and then disconcertingly somewhat, a small strip at the very bottom of the canvas breaks with the tonal atmospheric quality of the paint to give us something that's more like a conceptual rendition of a color test.
David and I always argue on panels, and now we're competing over description.
Yeah, here's an artist where all four people on the panel adore the painter, and we're still managing to have an argument.
Right. The other thing I just want to point out, if you ever teach, you know, art writing or whatever, art history, you know, you always tell your students, like, look at that checklist. So, for instance, there's funny, lots of funny things. So, for instance, with the Mama Anderson, where it says oil on panel, usually when you see oil on panel, it means it's a nice panel, you know, so it's a fancy maple sanded down, and so that felt like a trick. When I looked at it, I was like, oh, oil on panel, that's oil on plywood. So there's a kind of verbal trick. All of the works here say acrylic on canvas, and so when you hit those that have this kind of nylon thing, I literally was like, am I looking at the same thing? So there's a kind of trick there where he's sort of withholding information from you if you wanted it, you know, if you wanted to go by the checklist. So it's kind of like a painter being like, I'm not going to tell you, just look at that, you know, and you tell me what you see. And you're like, I don't see acrylic on canvas, but okay. So I don't know. I think that's all I had to say, but
it's kind of amazing that it is acrylic, because I usually think of, you know, what I like is oil painting, and then I love these paintings, and then I too looked at the checklist and I said, wait a minute, this is acrylic on canvas. You know, how does he get those effects out of acrylic?
Incredibly tactile.
Yeah, this is something I was aware of right from the get-go with Merlin. In the interest of full disclosure, I live with his work as well as writing about it and curating exhibitions of it. He likes acrylic, I think, because of its resistance. That the extraordinary thing with Merlin James is that they seem effortless, casual, relaxed sort of paintings, but at the same time, they are sort of anxious objects in Harold Rosenberg's sense. They're constantly, unaware. They're constantly anxious about their own identity. They instill in you, the viewer, questions rather than giving you painterly answers. And for him, I think acrylic is about oil being too nice and too easy, and being forced to get. To be forced to get something that approximates the pleasures that this person has with the whole history of oil painting, but to do it in acrylic is a way of almost a sort of self-flagellatory way of saying, I am not a postmodernist, but I'm in the postmodern era.
Well, it's of his time, but it also could be a challenge to himself, or a way of imposing an obstacle. Similar to how de Kooning would, you know, complicate the things that he could do with ease.
Right, right. All the way Modigliani would tie his dominant hand behind his back and force himself to work with the non-dominant hand to frustrate facility. Yes, but then of course he gets and achieves, I think, immense facility, a sort of oiliness and acrylic. I mean, so many artists give us a kind of plastic quality despite using the most fancy oils. What do you, as somebody who's actually handled the paintings, Chris, and presumably installed, what's your feeling towards the materiality in Merlin James?
Well, I wrote a couple notes down. One of the things that they're in the quirkiest way, they're lapidarian paintings. Like, and I have full disclosure, I have a really deep love for paintings that are smaller than 3 feet. I prefer them for the most part. And so there's an affection there for just that gesture. not talking about the materiality of the paintings directly, one of the things that I said to Vincent, because we just went to look at some work just in the neighborhood and met up there, I said that, and I just wrote this note, that he is not afraid to be a dilettante or to give a nod to the dilettante. Mm-hmm. He also is, as far as I can tell, not afraid of the amateur. And the, mm-hmm. and in some ways, there's this kind of nod to the daily practice of the bad, or of the so-called bad or unknown painter, who is frustrated with himself, constantly questioning himself, and yet kind of plows forward, and through that plowing forward as a painter develops a language and a style and a vocabulary, and basically creates a world. And the thing that's interesting to me about the kind of world in painting that is specific to just James, as far as I'm interested in talking about it, that there's you can see him kind of relishing all of the moves that he makes, and he even in some ways I feel like he makes fun of himself, like the bowed canvases. I mean, usually you get bowing from changes of weather and poor storage and that sort of thing, and I'm sure at some point in his practice he probably found a canvas that was bowed and shitty and decided to paint on it and really liked the presence of a painting that is like breathing with the weather and with the changes of temperature in the house and or the studio or wherever. And then in the exhibition, he turns one of the paintings around that has been consciously warped, and you actually see the construction that makes them warp. So he basically has, I wish we could have a chalkboard or something, but he basically draws blocks. I mean, he cut out blocks that are large on this side, and they descend, and then they get bigger like that. And then he nails the side of the stretcher board to it, the side of the stretcher bar, so it bows with it. So it's like a kind of architectural kind of carpentry move.
It's a hard won sloppiness.
And and he does that on all four sides. And so there's like this. At a certain point, he's quoting himself, he's kind of making fun of himself, and then like he's appropriating from the history, from the personal history of his practice. And like all of those moves are so insular and introverted and poetic. And you know, it's it is one of the things that is rare, I think, in contemporary art. And particularly rare to be shown at a level at which in a gallery that functions at the level at which Brent and Mike and Michael function at. It's rare to see artists who are completely dedicated to themselves, you know, and very interested, you know, and not afraid of their limitations and of their interest. The market be damned. Mm-hmm. You know, what's happening around them be damned. They just do their work, and it's a very skillful balance, I think, to grow at your own pace. And particularly, I don't know his age, but I'm guessing he's around 50.
52.
Okay, and to accept that 52 is like kind of early,
or maybe
early mid career or late emerging.
He and I are both 54.
54, exactly. I know he's the third, that same age. So.
And realize, you know, being comfortable with the fact that, okay, so the last 10 or 15 years show this slow growth, but then there are potentially another 30 or 40. And so it doesn't, you know, that you get to see him kind of expansively treat a set of ideas over and over again. And I like that.
Yeah, the holes in the cam. I remember once years ago overhearing somebody at one of his openings say, oh, gee, it was the first show when we saw a lot of holes in his canvases. And somebody said, oh, it's typical Merlin. Their paintings, they arrive ready damaged. And there is that mystique almost in his work that these are sort of forlorn paintings. These are paintings that could have been found in the attic or something of a very eccentric Sunday painter. I mean, it's interesting that he then, as an art sort of connoisseur, latches onto figures who are marginal or overlooked or eccentric throughout the history of art. But I mean, his obsession for several years now has been Serge Chachoun, the great unknown Russian Dadaist of about 1922 or something. So, but he, there's nothing tongue in cheek about this this infatuation. It's something very genuine. And it, actually, you know, you say market be damned, Chris. I feel we need to move on, and that's what we should have said about Merlin James. And I don't want to open a can of worms and get into a whole discussion that I always try to keep out of the review panel when people mention prices. But I just saw a news item yesterday about this afternoon about I won't mention his name, but an artist who's dived at auction and talking about, actually it's a piece in the Times, so you can go and see it. It's an artist who's has a hugely expensive studio practice, but after his sort of 15 minutes or whatever, his works went for a shameful, scandalous mere $23,000 at auction, and that's about the highest you could pay, or about the average I think for a Merlin James. So, and that's at retail. So there's something quite extraordinary about the fact that you can have four quite diverse critics, and it's very rare on the review panel for basically to have a love-in. There's usually some debate, right? There's usually some caveats, and yet,
well, I've found it's debate.
The market is in one place, and criticism is in another, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, we're not having much debate here, but I have found debate when I've tried to teach Merlin James.
All right.
Well, particularly his criticism, because he's very prolific as a critic as well. And this piece I love, I read it over and over, it's called The Non-Existence of Art Criticism. And I feel like it's not accessible, so I think I'm going to ask him if I can put it online, or maybe he has it put it online himself. But he in this class I was teaching at SVA, he was, and I somehow thought that everyone was just going to think he was marvelous. But they, in fact, thought that he was reactionary.
Yes.
And because he has a thing in here which he talks about, which is against literalism, and that covers a broad spectrum of things that he sees in contemporary art. But it boils down to that the work of art should have something left over that's not instantaneously understood. And I find that a lot with it, you know, seeing his work, even though I know it quite well. Like the punctures, for example, like I'm still not sure why they're there, and I feel like, again, a priori, I wouldn't like that. It would seem like a trick, but I don't have that reaction.
Right. Yeah, I think between a painter and somebody who has a practice also as a critic, the critic is obviously going to have some followers and some dissenters. I don't think any critic can really get everyone behind a radical critique of our lovely art world. But I just throw out that interesting example of how there can be some relative consensus among critics who are enthusiastic about an artist and no connection to collector or dealer or collector interest, seemingly. But let's hear comments from the audience at this stage on the first two shows we've looked at, Mamma Anderson and Merlin James. And if possible, can we maybe do it in that order? So hold back on James for the moment. Would anyone like to share with us some reaction to the discussion or to their own reaction to the shows to the show of Mamma Anderson? Yes.
Just curious if you had any sort of reaction to the fact that her mural was going to be destroyed at the end of the show. And if that, any of you, and if that impacted or would impact how you saw it.
I didn't even know that. I'm delighted to hear it. No.
I was going to say the same thing.
All right. No, what Martha was going to say is, do we have to wait till the end of the show? No. We didn't really get into it, but the blow-up of scale, I felt, undermined what she'd achieved in the paintings that I liked very much in the principal gallery. It's and especially actually having one of the regular scaled paintings in the space of the humongous mural, it seemed to present something conceptually that it almost seemed that the artist herself didn't understand. So
I didn't even know that, but that sounds gimmicky to me. Why?
Someone wants to buy it and you were willing to show it.
I'm destroying this. Okay.
I don't think it makes any difference. I mean, it wouldn't make me any difference one way or the other.
Wouldn't make any difference.
That it's going to be destroyed. Yes. Knowing that I did not know that it was going to be destroyed, but now that you say it, it makes it even sound worse. I mean, yeah, that's something.
Yeah. Yes. It's like the old joke about the Catskills, you know, the food's inedible in such small portions. You know, so the mural's a failure, and it's not going to last, you know.
Well. I mean, again, it almost sounds like a kind of Werner thing. Like, you know, we're very expensive, but we're actually going to destroy that. It's like, go ahead. We don't care. But that's just, you know, that's just a few art critics. I don't know. Did you think were you kind of like, oh, my gosh?
Well, it was funny. Once I knew that, I started thinking of sand paintings, and the tradition of Tibetan sand paintings, which you know sort of evoke so much history, and then they're destroyed, and that was just sort of an overlay for me in terms of seeing that.
Right.
Yeah. But I think there's kind of a you know, site-specific work has that inherent in it, and sometimes it's very provocative, and it really adds to it. And you know, there's a Solowit installation right now. It's a Carl Andre sculpture in Solowit wall paintings at Paula Cooper. That's just like an amazing installation. You feel like it should be there forever, but it's not going to be there forever. And that, in that case, you do feel, but it's part of the concept of it that it is going to go away in time. And this, it just seemed kind of arbitrary. That was my feeling.
I mean, just one more thing. There's so much work that was programmed to not, you know, exist and then was made to exist, you know, forever, supposedly. So, I mean, Duchamp or anything, you know, these things were not made to last forever. So, I don't know. Maybe I'd sort of have the reverse where more people should have honored that, you know? Like, once you learn, like, well, what about, you know, you're teaching performance or something, and you're like, you know, Gagosian bought, like, all this paraphernalia that Chris Burden used in his graduate school performances. Really? Mm-hmm. The lock? You know, the whole bit. So, I mean, that's just a whole longer thing. I don't know.
I'm reminded of Michael Landy, who had a project once. We had this wonderful kind of skip, and you could take your art there, and it would be destroyed. So, it wasn't big enough, I don't think, for the Mama Anderson murals, anyway. I think there were some hands went there, and yes.
Did you get the sense at all from the Mama Anderson that it was like a historical museum? I mean, it seemed to me that the whole piece was about taking pieces from a museum, especially a museum of women's artifacts, and making icons of those items. I mean, I found such charm in that idea. And charm in the images, and especially because they're so feminine, and it's so unusual for artists to make an icon out of something that we consider images. For example, the pieces of clothing, in the bodices, and then again in the there was a piece in the back with different pieces of clothing as though they were hung up. And I thought it was interesting too that in both of those, the one with the bodices, it was hard to see, but it looked as though they were hung up, as though they were suspended. And to me, that also made it seem like it was something important. It was hung like a piece of art. And so the idea of taking those images and sort of putting them on a pedestal, to me, was sort of feminist and extremely interesting. And just her, the way that she mixes things that are just gorgeously rendered and so almost photorealistic with just a few brushstrokes, and that against things almost sometimes in the same painting that are just an idea of a form. So you have this incredible photorealism in the same painting with something that's just a few dots. Right. And I just find that lovely and charming.
Fantastic. Right. Thank you very much. No, I'm really pleased to have taken a very, very affirm, to take a comment that was very supportive of that show. I would take this moment opportunity to mention that there are some seats in the front, so unless you actually enjoy it and it's in part of your daily exercise, if you are perched on a windowsill or leaning on the back of the room, don't feel ostracized. There is place for you to sit, and this is a good moment if you want to find a seat. So Merlin James, any feelings from the audience on the subject of Merlin James's show, or are four peons enough for one evening? I don't know. Any comments on? Yes, there is at the back of the hall on Merlin James.
Hi, thanks. Interesting panel. And full disclosure, I like Chris. I'm a freelance art handler and worked on the current Merlin James show. And I like everything the panel's been saying about his work, and especially Chris, because he, like I, have seen the work up close from the back, sideways, upside down, because we've handled it and put it on the walls. And I've seen it grow, and Chris mentioned the slow development in the work, or somebody did, which I agree with. And the work that's transparent and on a nylon, I think, when it's fairly new development. I've seen it in the gallery for about 4 or 5 years, but it's grown and expanded, all under 3 feet, as Chris mentioned, but still there's this expansion in it, and which I enjoyed a lot. The gallery, you know, I'll just let you know, didn't quite know what to make of them when they first appeared. And but the artists who work in the gallery kind of saw it immediately for, you know, the important work that it really is. And there's, in Merlin's craft, in the studio, he makes these tiny little houses out of wood, and they started to appear on the back of the stretchers and the transparent pieces and on the tops of the stretchers. So just sitting there, some aren't glued on, some are, but the ones you can see from the back through the transparent layers have a life, you know, a quality that is really unusual. And so that there's that interaction between the life behind the transparent surface and the life on the surface of the transparent, which has its own color. So there's that incredible interaction between them, which I enjoyed a lot by looking at them. And it was a pleasure to work on the show. And he is an interesting, fascinating person to talk with.
Great. Thank you very much. Thank you. Anybody else at this stage on Merlin James? Somebody taking issue? Somebody want to sort of add a cautionary note on our over-enthusiasm? Or is there some key aspect that we've missed in our sort of pointless love-ins? Yes?
I have a question that's going to sound like a snotty question, but it's actually an authentic question, which was, so take it that way, or take it snotty, whatever. But hearing the descriptions of seeing the shows, I've been thinking a lot about time and how long it takes to look at something. And so there seemed like this gradient between, like, I didn't even get close enough to the painting to look at it, I was turned off by the room, to obviously very deep looking, engaged looking that happened with certain Merlin James paintings. And like, I'm just interested in that as a situation, like how long do you look at things, and how do they solicit that distinction between like not going close enough to see if it was painted well or not, to like seeing the tiny house on the things? And how does that, I mean, do you see any trend in like the way a gallery functions or a painting looks to make that happen?
Yeah, do we as critics have a sort of strict rule? Okay, everyone is like a trade union, the artist is entitled to 17.2 minutes per show, or is it, does the art itself, as it were, dictate the time it gets? Well, Martha, I don't think anyone on the panel sees more art than you do, so what would you say?
I'm going to hijack that question. That's Jarrett Ernest, if you don't know. He writes for the Brooklyn Rail. He's an amazing critic, and I thought... as we were talking about Mama Anderson, I was like, he's gonna like that Mama Anderson.
did you like it?
If this is not the play, I mean.
Oh, okay. I saw that big woman, and I thought, you know, well, there's a way you mic, could sort of spin like, that big, that gigantic woman, and maybe you would make me like it. So
I mean, I wanted to address that question because I think for everyone, at what you're talking about is, and you're talking about a very specific aspect of the context in which you digest art, right? And time is, I think, is a huge component with that. I mean, one of the things about Merlin's work, Merlin James's work, as Gary, who's the art handler back there, fellow art handler, mentioned, is that we've had years with James's work. Before working there and working with it, I don't work there anymore, but you know, I've spent a ton of time really enjoying the work. So going to see the show, there are certain moves and certain things that are happening that I'm really familiar with, and I'm versed enough to make an assessment because of, in a short amount of time, I think Vincent and I were there for maybe 25 minutes, 30 minutes, and he had been there before. He was at the opening, I guess. You know, Mama Anderson, again, I speak at a disadvantage because I didn't see both rooms. It wasn't a matter of me coming in and just kind of zooming around. It was more there was pretension in it because of the lighting and the amount of space dedicated to work that did not deserve it in that particular room. I didn't see the other room. And so quickly what I started to assess is that this is not the best room to actually deal with this artist who I have no experience with. I did look at the paintings and I saw a person who understands painting and understands how painting works, but what was there and how it was shown. And then she had the disadvantage of me walking down the block to see the Paul Tech show at Alexander Bonin, and it just blew her shit away. And, you know, I was thinking about this with the wall painting, like, you know, that it was going to be destroyed, and the amount of pretense that is involved in just even putting that out there, not you, but the dealer and her as an artist making that choice. And I look at someone like Tech, whose materials were constantly failing. There's a room full of gessoed newspaper that's yellowing. The way that he worked at the end of his life, one of my favorite Paul Tech quotes is, I'm paraphrasing, I don't make beautiful paintings for ugly rich people. That's a person who is, talk about duration and dealing with time and context and really situating himself in such a way that he's being digested in a more human way and a vast, as part of the world, not as part of the art world. That's a different thing. And when you see someone who is engaged like that, you do pause and you linger. And I got off a train with bags when I saw these shows, and I just put my bags down when I got to Paul Tech and just set them at the door and just walked around and looked. And, you know, it's so the element of time is also about the commitment of the artist. If the artist is making work that indicates an investment and commitment to something outside of the market, which these big galleries kind of just represent on many levels, and that's not how an artist should necessarily be judged, but it's part of the viewing experience, you know, then I'm not gonna pay that artist that much attention unless they're really, really good, and they have some historical bearing that, you know, they've been vetted over the last 40, 50 years, and, you know, I'm gonna spend some time with it. You know, one more thing is another artist that I have spent a lot of time with, who fortunately or unfortunately has big support now, is Al Taylor. That's someone who I could spend hours with.